And we'll start with film reviews this evening. In fact, two up for review. Marianne and Leonard, Words of Love, from documentarian Nick Broomfield, about the on-off relationship between Marianne Illan and Leonard Cohen. And The Chambermaid, which is the feature debut from Mexican actor turned director Lila Avilés. And with me in studio, Hilary White and Cara Doherty, who have seen both. We'll start with Marianne and Leonard, Words of Love. Nick Broomfield was on the show recently with us. What exactly was the nature of the relationship? How would you describe it, Hilary, the relationship between Marianne Illan and Leonard Cohen?
Well, I think it's one of the fascinating things about this film is that a lot of people from the outside would have had quite a romanticised idea of their relationship, and this documentary opens it up and shows what was really behind it. So the two of them met in this idyllic Greek island called Idra. Cohen was down there to use it as a writing retreat, as a lot of people did during that time, during the late 50s, early 60s. And there he meets Marianne Illan, who is a Norwegian. She's there with her son. The husband has deserted them for another woman, and herself and Cohen hook up. She is very struck by the fact that he's this romantic poet and he's there following his muse, so to speak, and in doing so becomes his muse, as it was. She, in turn, then just decides that she'll help along by preparing food, from bringing him water, and kind of waiting on him, really.
You know? I'm sure there was a little bit more involved than just the food and water somehow. This was the 1960s, Cara, and I think neither of them in this documentary, nobody in this documentary is pretending anything otherwise than the island of Hedra was a particularly loose version of the already pretty loose 1960s in terms of sexual convention.
It was an island of, it was pure hedonism. I mean, they were all having affairs with each other, if you can even call them affairs. They were basically sleeping with everybody else, taking every drug under the sun, and supposedly all creating and thinking and coming up with these sort of great artistic pieces of work, but at the same time driving themselves quite mad. Cohen himself had a nervous breakdown after he sat in the sun for days on end, in the boiling sun, so he could write a book. Literally, I'd say,
boiling
his brains out. Yeah. It was an odd little island that seems to have gotten into all of their skin, because they were all still talking about it in the documentary as this absolute heaven that they just want to go back to.
And when you said they were all still talking about, who do we hear from Leonard Cohen? There's a lot of archive material here. We hear from Leonard Cohen. Do we hear from Illan? Do we hear from her?
Yes, yeah. She appears a few times throughout at different times, and then particularly in her later years. Towards the end, there's a very poignant moment where she shares something by distance with Cohen after years of them being apart.
Yeah, and she is we should make clear, she is the Marianne of the song "So Long, Marianne." She's the person who was the muse for that and many other songs.
Yeah, "Burn a Wire," I think, as well, was another song that was particularly about her. Yeah, as Cara was saying, this very final interaction between the two is kind of the frame for the entire film. So this is Marianne on her deathbed in 2016.
All right, now I get the sense that we're into the romantic side of things, though. Does it take a while to get there?
No, I think it kind of bookends it with romance, and then in the space in between, it shows you quite a lot of disillusionment and quite a lot of casualties from an era which, as we know, was very hedonistic and quite selfish in its bohemian ideals.
And lots of those casualties, children of the Hedra. Affairs, essentially.
And it's quite hard to watch. An awful lot of children were born into this mix. When Marianne went to the island, she had a son, Axel, who she brought with her. But these children were kind of almost left to be feral and wild while the adults all around them took drugs and slept with each other. And a lot of them didn't make it beyond through their teenage years, and other ones ended up with very severe mental health issues. So a lot of...
And the drug taking was not confined to the adults.
There's a mention of a child who, I think maybe a 13-year-old, and somebody popped something into his drink almost just to see what would happen. A crazy time.
All right, well, here's a clip featuring Leonard Cohen, and he's talking about the nature of his relationship and the value of the company of women. Now, make what you can of this.
I had a great appetite for the company of women and for the sexual expression of friendship. And I was very fortunate because it was the 60s, and that possibility was very, very present. And for a tiny moment in social history, there was a tremendous cooperation between men and women about that particular item. And so I was very lucky that that my appetite coincided with this very rare, what, religious, social, I don't know what you'd call it, some kind of phenomenon, you know, that allowed men and women, boys and girls we were, to come together in that kind of union that satisfied both the appetites.
And there you have Leonard Cohen from the film Marianne and Leonard, Words of Love. The sexual expression of friendship. In these post-Me Too days, is it hard to take that? Although he does go on to explain that was the nature of that society.
Yeah, I sort of watched it part horrified with Me Too eyes, and I just thought, if looking at it from now's perspective, he just was an insatiable, kind of power-hungry man who devoured women left, right and centre.
But does he make a reasonable point that
So when you have to remove the kind of Me Too from your brain and watch it with this of sensibilities of the 1960s, when it very much was a time where anything went, really. I mean, there's one point where there's a clip of a woman, she's not named, but she looks like a model, and she is practically stripping the man as he stands there as they have a conversation. And it's very, they're very free, they're very open. So yeah, if you leave out modern sensibilities, but at the same time, Marianne was very much left broken for many years because of how he was with her. So,
and the other thing is one of the other interesting aspects of this film is the director, Nick Broomfield, was also a lover of Marianne Illins. Was he a long-term lover, or was it one of these short dalliances on the island of Hedra?
Short dalliance, on and off. She visited him in London then subsequently afterwards. He seemed like one of these characters who she would run to when Cohen was predisposed or not able to host her, because Cohen and herself, their paths diverged and converged over a number of years, and they run to each other, and then they combust and they separate, and then they come back together again. So she was, you know, quite a victim of his whims, and there's even one of the commentators in it who said you couldn't really fall in love with Cohen. He was too selfish. He was too obsessed with his own artistic pursuits.
And is that all written off as
himself over?
Yeah, is that written off as a kind of artistic temperament then?
Well, it is, but I think it's in a sense it's also sort of highlighting that people like this are not the kind of people to expect a solid, stable relationship from.
Let's listen to him after. The song itself, I presume, is featured in the documentary as well. Well, in fact, here's the bit where he's introducing it in a live performance. And a lot of this material is archiving. I don't think the documentary is clear in telling us where exactly it comes from. But here he is introducing the song Marianne and talking about the nature of the relationship and how it informed the song.
This song is about the girl I used to live with. I lived with her for about 8 years. Her name was Marianne. And I used to live with her, you know, about 6 months of the year. And then the other 6 months of the year, I was split to somewhere else. Then I found out I was only living with her 4 months of the year. And then 2 months of the year. And then about the eighth year, I was living with her a couple of weeks of the year. But I thought it was time to write this particular song for her. I still live with her a couple of days of the year.
I don't know if he played that. I still lived with her a couple of days of the year for laughs. He got the laugh from the audience, but it doesn't make him come out great, does it?
No, certainly not at that moment. And there's another time in the documentary where he's sort of there saying, oh, she might be here. I hope she's here. Oh, I don't really know if she's here. It doesn't really matter.
Well, during that particular clip you're talking about, it was at the Isle of Wight Festival, and he says afterwards he was completely off his face on Mandrax. There's a lot of, told about a lot of drug taking going on in this era.
Who is this documentary about, though? Does it? Because Broomfield says that he wanted to put Marianne Illin centre, front and centre. Does she remain there, or does it ultimately become a documentary about Cohen?
I think it's more of a Cohen story, because it goes right back to his origins, how he came to be, his early days, and his rise to stardom.
And he was just rising to stardom around the time he met her, really, wasn't he?
Well, he was a struggling poet when they met, and then the music came
subsequent to that. Yeah. Okay. So, Did you enjoy the film despite all of the kind of... I'm hearing a lot of caveats from both of you.
I know, it did. I went through... I suppose like a lot of people, I went through a Coen phase at one point in time, and he's from seeing this, he's a very different person than I thought he was. I do think it's really interesting. It's quite thought-provoking, especially when you start looking at it with today's kind of eyes. And I think if you're a fan, and if you're a proper fan of his, you do need to see this. And there's some funny bits in there as well. I would say, though, it gets quite confusing at times, the chronology, and I find I got quite lost between when was this, when was that, when.
So I think
he probably made it very much for Coen fans,
right?
So if you're in the middle there, you will struggle at times to keep up.
And what does that how does that translate into stars from you, Cara?
Yeah, I still went with the four in the end, and definitely for fans out there, but I think the rest of us could have done with a little bit of help. Or
all right. Okay. What are you saying, Hilary?
I'd say something similar, apart from the fact that I wouldn't have been a huge Coen disciple. I always would have watched him from a distance. I would have known his big hits, and I actually came out understanding him a lot clearer. I always had this idea he was the more sort of noble, poetic end of you know, rock and roll excess.
And that's not what you get here.
He was as down and dirty as the rest of them.
Well,
really,
according to this film, anyway.
According to this, indeed, yeah. So
I suppose you have to put the Nick Broomfield relationship into the mix in that.
Sure, I did like the framing device, though, of her final moments and the letter that he wrote to her. I thought that was quite touching, and the archive collection material and interview footage is very good, very comprehensive.
Do we hear the song in full performed, or is it just snippets of it here and there?
We get snippets here and there. Yeah. That's it. I don't think there's any one song that's played the whole way through, which is quite unusual for a music documentary.
Yeah. Maybe go off and listen to the music and put the biography bits to the one side when you're listening to the music. Sometimes you just have to do that. Mm. All right, 3.5 and 4 then, I think we said in terms of our first film, Marianne and Leonard, Words of Love. Let's move on then to The Chambermaid, the inner workings of a 5-star hotel in Mexico. What's the nature of the hotel, Cara, and who are we with? Because we're with one person really for the most of it, aren't we?
It's one of those very, very nice, kind of a bland, I'd imagine 5-star, definitely a good 4-star hotel. One of those kind of faceless ones that look the same. And we follow through the eyes of Eve, who's a chambermaid. She's played by Gabriella Cartol, I'm assuming. Yeah. And we really only ever see the world of the hotel through her eyes, but it's all set in the corridors behind what you ever see as a resident or a guest. It's sort of the inner secrets of how a hotel works, all the behind the scenes things. So it's this odd mix of very practical. We literally see how our beds end up perfectly made in a hotel, and how everything, there isn't a crease in sight. So from one side, it's this sort of almost like a documentary on how this comes to be. But on the other side of it, it's this quite kind of dark story of the people that we don't really ever get to see in those hotels.
And predominantly this character of Eve, played by Gabriella Cartol. Now, we're following her from room to room, but she's quite an ambitious woman.
Mm, yeah. One of the fascinating things about this film is that it's almost like a microcosm for the social ills through developing Mexico. So she is at the lower rung of the ladder in terms of both the social strata, but also the strata within this hotel, and she's trying to better herself. And it's kind of measured through the floors that you work on. The higher up the hotel, the more prestigious the...
So wait, where's she now? What floor
she's
on now?
She's trying to get to the 42nd. I think she's on
the
21st.
But her ambition is to get the 42nd.
Is that where the
penthouse suites are. Been recently refurbished. That's where the millionaires... And if you're overseeing that, your wage packet goes up. She's got a 4-year-old son at home.
Who she never sees
because she's too busy working in here and trying to negotiate this place. And also there is an education program which is run by the Hoteliers Union, and she's doing this. It's sort of it's basic education, isn't it?
She does make a
friend. Is it Minotoy?
Yeah, Minotoy, who kind of comes into this, and she's almost quite sinister.
She's another chambermaid.
Yeah,
she's
a chambermaid on a different floor. They become friends in the classroom, and she's this very very outgoing, almost actually overbearing woman. But it's designed that we're always on our nerves because we don't really know what she wants, or does she just want a new friend? What's going on there? So there's this sense of unease that runs through the whole film, and she's a well, I can't really say what she is because I might spoil things.
Right, thank you.
Yes. Do not do that.
But it takes us a while to figure out what's going on there.
What exactly is going on with her? One of the other things is, I presume, since we're in a room with, in lots of cases, the Eve character, Gabriella Cartol's character, by herself fixing a bed or cleaning a bathroom or hoovering a floor or whatever it is, I presume a lot of this is pure action and absolutely no dialogue or very little dialogue.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are some cases where she's in there and there is a guest there at the same time. There's one, there's a gentleman who's there working on his laptop who's like incredibly rude to her. And then there's also a young mother who's quite glamorous from Argentina who sort of adopts her and is quite patronising, saying, oh, will you come up here and help me look after my child? And, oh, here's some face cream to make you look more beautiful so you'll get a boyfriend and things. So it's kind of showing you how somebody in Eva's position is viewed by people who are higher up the social ladder than she is.
And the director here, Lila Avila, is an actor, and she had written, an actor turned director, and she had written this as a play, I think, first of all. There's a kind of a static nature, but she makes a virtue of that, I think, with the camera, doesn't she?
So the camera doesn't move. Once it's set up, that's it. The action all takes place initially. It's everything that happens around it.
So there's no movement of the camera at all, just the characters move.
Some very slow panning in a couple of quite striking scenes, but yes.
But the sort of, I'd say 90% of it is just this static camera and things that happen in and around past the camera. So it's, again, it kind of creates this really kind of anxious feeling. I was very stressed watching it though.
I didn't feel too stressed. I thought that naturalistic approach with the direction was that actually made it a very thorough character study. Examine her, you know, and observe her at a very intimate level, I thought.
Because often when you see this transfer of a play to a film, the problem is, oh yeah, that'd be great if you were standing looking at a stage and you saw the characters moving and the interactions of the blocking and things like that brings its own drama to it. But you're saying that, in fact, this static camera is a good choice, Henry.
Absolutely, and I thought the blocking was really good. There's a couple of scenes where you have characters at quite different ends of the frame. There's one, there's a window cleaner who she's having a bit of a flirtatious they're sussing each other out, and he's cleaning the windows on the outside
on the 21st floor.
And she's
concentrating your job, young man.
And I thought it was actually very striking, very very well done. You know,
there was another scene that I saw where they were in a laundry cupboard, and there were two women in the laundry cupboard, and all the sheets and towels were along the shelves and almost in front of the cameras. When I thought, jeepers, how are any of us going to fit in? I was almost holding my breath watching it because it felt so tight and squeezed.
Yes, it's so claustrophobic. There's times where she goes into the cupboard, you know, where you get all your tiny miniatures in your bathroom in your hotel. So there's a cupboard where there's just thousands and thousands of little bottles, and she's in filling her cart up with them.
I want that cupboard.
I want that cupboard too. I don't want to go into it though, because I don't think I'd ever get out again. But it's that small a space. But again, it's that really claustrophobic use of space. Yeah.
All right. It sounds as if you both, I don't know if enjoyed is the right word, but you were suitably stressed. 4-star, 5-star hotel, you said. What about the film?
Well, I really thought it was great. She's brilliant. For somebody who doesn't have to say much, she just really conveys an awful lot. There's one scene that Hilary briefly mentioned, but without going into it, that although looked quite stunning from a distance, she does something that I could not understand. It is completely out of character, and I couldn't fathom the reason for that being there. I just thought, just no on a million levels. It would have been 5 stars, but that scene knocked a star.
But you're not telling
4.
Us because you think it's not something we should know. All right, okay. And what are you saying, Hilary?
I'm going to go with the hotel rating, give it the full 5 stars. I thought it was a really fascinating character study. I thought it was saying so much about the society outside the hotel, which we never see. It seemed to be able to say a lot about that by staying within the confines of the hotel. I thought she was superb. The scene that Cara is referencing, I thought, just added another dimension to her and humanised her even further.
Right.
And as a first-time director for Lila Aviles, I'm going to be really interested to see what she does after this.
Okay, on the basis of that, I want to go and see what that scene is. Alone, apart from anything else. So Marianne Leonard, Words of Love, and The Chambermaid, both on limited release. But before Cara Doherty and Hilary White head off, obviously the death announced today of Rutger Hauer. Blade Runner is the immediate thing we're going to think of here, Cara.
It's absolutely iconic. It really is. I think for a lot of people, that might be the only thing that people really think of. I mean, he did so many films and so much TV as well. But that's the real standout.
The amazing thing about him, though, he's one of these guys who turn up unexpectedly in films like Batman Begins or Sin City. And you go, there's Rutger Hauer. And he was just so reliable, that sort of Northern European iciness he'd bring to any role that he's doing. But Blade Runner, I suppose, is just, it's so iconic, his role. Just that speech that he gives, that monologue, is part of cinema history.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that most recently he was seen in The Sisters Brothers, but I guess most people remember John C. Reilly and Joaquin Phoenix from that rather than... Was it quite often just little cameo roles then that he had as opposed to what he had in what he played, the replicant in Blade Runner?
I think cameo roles that would... leaving a bit of an indelible mark, if you like, maybe just slightly more prestigious than a cameo role, because he was an iconic actor. I mean, I think about those Guinness ads that he used to do, which were, you know, people's favourites. You know, they love them.
Yeah. Well, there's really only one clip you can play, and I think I've heard it a few times already today, but it is the only clip you can play because it's the best clip that you can play, and hearing it several times today in particular is no harm at all. Famous scene from Blade Runner. Remember, it's raining outside.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Ten Hauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time. Like tears.
The voice there of Rutger Hauer, who died last Friday, in fact, July the 19th, but the news wasn't really broken until recent days. His funeral, a private funeral, took place on yesterday, Wednesday, July the 24th.